This is another bonus episode of Landslide. It's a production of Nuanced Tales in partnership with WFAE and distributed by the NPR network. In the early and mid-1970s, hundreds of thousands of people, and then millions of people, began to receive a certain kind of letter in their mailboxes. They opened direct mail that alerted them to a conservative cause, a backlash to new textbooks or women's rights, for instance. The letters contained alarmist, apocalyptic language, and then asked for money. But they weren't just fundraising. These letters from the New Right were an alternative form of media.
The only communications channel that you had directly to conservatives was mail.
Leaders of the New Right obsessed over the news and how to have their own news. The publisher Richard Vickery expanded to launch magazines, Conservative Digest and the New Right Report. But there was one long-held media goal the New Right sought to achieve and failed at over and over before a stunning success. They wanted their own television news channel. Catherine Kramer Brownell is a professor of history at Purdue and the author of the book 24/7 Politics. And she's here to sketch out what the New Right wanted from television news, what it attempted to do, and how it played into today's media landscape. Katie, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start in the middle, right where we just heard, which is New Right leaders wanted a piece of television news. Why did they want it? What opportunity did they see with television? And then let's talk about their first effort to get it.
So they saw television, as so many people did across the political spectrum in American politics in the 1970s, as the source of political power. They were convinced that the dominant television programming that so many people, millions of people consumed across the country, was liberally biased. And they were determined to try to establish an alternative form of television as a way to get their ideas out there.
Yeah. And so at this point, we're in the early to mid-1970s, I believe. I think we're talking about like 1973 right now. So this is sort of when the seeds of the story we hear in Landslide are happening. You're starting to have these protests around the country against textbooks and integrating schools through busing students. You're starting to have the backlash against the Equal Rights Amendment. And there is a sort of first attempt at this television news model. What is that attempt?
It's called TVN, which stood for TV News. And it was a very explicit conservative project. And it's funded by conservatives who want to wage a war of ideas. At the time, news programs are overwhelmingly produced by the three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. And so TVN, the idea behind it is to create these news segments that have a more conservative angle and distribute them to local TV stations.
So basically, the way this is working is they're feeding out. They're saying, hey, here are our stories. If you're a TV station, you can grab these stories and you can play them.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is the strategy, in theory, had a lot of appeal because many television station owners at the local level were more conservative. They bought into this idea of liberal media bias.
Well, let's step back and talk a little bit about that as well, because I think you've made the case to me that there was a legitimate grievance about the way that television news worked in this era. And it was a grievance both among conservatives and among liberals and pretty widespread. So why don't we talk about that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. I think today there's a tendency to romanticize this moment in the 1960s where everyone got their news and even entertainment from shared sources. But in reality, those sources were very elitist, very exclusionary. They relied on official sources, and they overwhelmingly reflected a worldview defined by elite, white, straight men in New York City. And so their perspective on what was important, their close relationship with the political establishment really shaped these programming across all three networks.
I remember covering George McGovern, the 1972 Democratic nominee, and when he's first kind of emerging as a candidate, he's at like 3% in the polls. So he's given absolutely no shot of winning the Democratic nomination. And he really blames the media establishment. We're not just talking about television, but we're talking about print as well. These people who he says kind of get together at their clubs and decide who's got a chance and who doesn't. And I just remember him, you know, being very, very bitter about it at the outset of that race.
I'm beginning to think that there is such a thing as an Eastern establishment press. They sort of agree on who they think the front runner is, and then everything has to fit that mold.
So who was the first major politician who really sought to popularize the concept of a liberal biased media?
Without a doubt, it is Richard Nixon. And he is incredibly effective at really elevating this issue about a liberal media bias. Exactly what you're saying, that it's elitist gossip that is shaping the news, not, you know, what's actually happening. He calls it the network news problem, quote unquote. And this is this multifaceted, multi-pronged effort to derail the credibility and to really target the pocketbooks of network newsrooms and the big three networks. And it's one of those issues that really does endear Nixon to conservatives who are actually not very happy with many of his other issues that he's pursuing. But for Nixon, it's very personal. For him, liberal media bias means personal bias against Nixon.
Yeah, I mean, Nixon has this incredible relationship throughout his career with television news in particular. I mean, you could probably go back to McCarthyism and the committee hearings over communist sympathies and the Red Scare.
You're absolutely right. He becomes obsessed with controlling his television image because he sees his great triumphs, the HUAC hearings, you know, getting a piece of the spotlight through televised congressional hearings as central to his political rise.
I am holding in my hand a microfilm, a very highly confidential secret State Department document.
And then there's this really interesting component in the 1960 election where there's this assumption that he didn't take television seriously. He did. He tried to present himself that he was authentic. He sits on a desk. He talks to the camera. He doesn't want to have any glitz and glamour and tries to use that to critique Kennedy for being too much about style and not about enough about substance. But he saw when Kennedy won, he thought, wow, I have to be more entertaining. I have to, you know, appeal more directly to people. And I have to find ways to go around the network news programs that he felt were not giving him a fair shake. And this is how he comes to meet Roger Ailes,
who goes on to found Fox News.
He's going on the Mike Douglas show, which is not a political show. It brings in a variety of different entertainment guests. And he sighs about having to do what he calls gimmicks like this to get elected. And Ailes shakes his head and says, television is not a gimmick. And he really emphasizes that Nixon needs to rethink his relationship to TV, make his approach more engaging and entertaining, and make it so he has more control over the message as well.
Yeah. And so then, you know, of course, Nixon has his presidency for about 6 years until he resigns due to Watergate. And over this time, he's pushing this idea of the network news problem. At the same time, we have conservatives also sort of similarly attacking it from other angles, pitching the New York Times, for instance, to say, hey, you don't have any conservative voices. And the New York Times ultimately hires William Safire, a conservative columnist who had been a speechwriter for Nixon. Safire becomes sort of a media establishment figure who can then attack from the pages of the New York Times various political figures, notably Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s, where Safire specifically helps inflame several scandals surrounding Jimmy Carter. He starts adding the suffix gate to things like investigations
ironic,
into Carter's
right?
bus director. Yeah, he's the one who starts doing it. And he does it in some ways because he is upset about Watergate. And he's upset that Nixon, his old boss, resigns during Watergate and that Watergate became the scandal that it does. So he wants to tag other things as it to make them seem equivalent to it. So you start to see this. And so you're starting to see kind of more of a infiltration of a viewpoint that had been considered extreme and fringe, at least by the establishment elites in New York who were making the news. And at the same time, we have TVN. So going back to TVN, this first sort of television news endeavor by the new right. It is started by Joseph Coors, the beer magnate, a key figure in these kind of conservative causes. Coors had also put the money behind the Heritage Foundation and acquiring the American Legislative Exchange Council. And the person that Coors, I think, works most closely with in the New Right is Paul Weyrich, who we hear in our story as one of the key figures and also kind of galvanizing the Christian right.
It's just like in battle, just like a war. And after all, this is a war, isn't it?
So Paul Weyrich is another key figure at TVN. So tell us sort of the story of what happens with TVN. They launch it. They try to do it. They have this sort of conservative media organism feeding stories to stations that want it. And it's a raging success, right? And it works really, really well. And we still have it today.
One would think. It's an incredible failure. They try to hire journalists that try to introduce more professional journalistic tactics. And Coors gets upset because it's not political enough. It's not ideologically driven. And so he's actively manipulating and inserting his political ideas into how the news is being created. But the real problem, they really struggled to disseminate these programs. And that was key because you have to get these programs from where they're made to stations across the country. And so the whole idea behind it is that they initially they would use AT&T.
It's literally coming through the phone lines. This is, you know, our pre-internet era.
Exactly.
So there's a technology problem that you're describing here.
Yeah, and it's expensive. It can be done, but that's what the networks do. And the big three networks spend a lot of money and have a really good relationship, a very lucrative relationship with AT&T. And so the rate for someone to also disseminate and use AT&T is exorbitantly high. And so their plan for dissemination really goes nowhere. By 1974, they're just really struggling. They bring in Roger Ailes to kind of help produce the better programs, but also to kind of go on a PR blitz and to kind of heighten demand for these types of programs. But they also kind of start this thinking about a different way of dissemination, and that is via satellite. So a commercial satellite dish is launched in 1974, and it's very cheap to kind of beam up the programs, but it's really expensive to receive them. They have to convince local stations to get an entire satellite receiver in order to get those. And so why would someone spend $100,000 to get just TVN programming?
And so what ultimately happens to TVN?
By the fall of 1975, TVN folds. And notably, it's in October that the first cable channel uses the satellite to disseminate their programs. And that's HBO.
So in some ways, TVN is kind of before its time in the sense that they saw where they needed to go. And if the technology had evolved a little bit more quickly, who knows, maybe they would still be around.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And there's sort of three threads because the story of TVN doesn't really end there. It's not like, oh, well, it was a failure and then people moved on and that was the end of the idea. There are three elements of this that we've mentioned coming out of it that I want to explore. So one is Roger Ailes, who had gotten his first experience on the news side of things. The second is Paul Weyrich, the New Right organizer. And then the third is just kind of cable news writ large. So maybe we could start there. TVN folds, but then why don't I just let you take it from there?
Well, TVN never figures out satellite distribution, but Reese Schoenfeld does the following year.
And Schoenfeld had been at TVN.
Yeah, yes, he was. And so after HBO launches a very successful experiment and convinces cable operators across the country and helps them buy these satellite receivers, all of a sudden the cable dial is starting to explode. All types of new entrepreneurs are coming and thinking about the possibilities of having niche channels that serve a very particular purpose to narrow audiences like ESPN and MTV. And Ted Turner meets Reese Schoenfeld, knows about his work, and realizes that maybe there's a possibility to do 24/7 news. And he brings Schoenfeld in to launch CNN in 1980.
TVN had failed, but it directly contributed to CNN, the first 24/7 cable news channel, proof that such a channel could succeed. And the New Right was not done shopping for its own conservative version. In the decade after TVN's failure, the New Right saw unprecedented success on other fronts, It became the powerhouse of outside political spending and fundraising.
The American Conservative Union began a blitz of television commercials today.
A conservative president won in a landslide.
I am not frightened by what lies ahead, and I don't believe the American people are frightened by what lies ahead.
And the dream of a conservative television network lived on. In 1985, the Senator Jesse Helms, his right-hand man Tom Ellis, and their allies launched a bid to take over one of the big three networks, CBS. The Washington Post described the next several months as a fight for survival. CBS did survive, ultimately. The new right takeover failed. But a few years later, Paul Weyrich took another chance, this time with a fully-fledged conservative cable network.
The National Empowerment Television, NET. And it's funded by Weyrich, and it goes live in 1993. And it's very much about having an explicitly political, ideological, conservative take on the news. And it's unabashed in that it's going to present a conservative viewpoint. Their tagline is C-SPAN with an attitude.
Great.
It's very dry, very boring.
Next, incoming House Speaker Newt Gingrich co-hosting a 45-minute discussion on cable television technology.
It struggles to get carriage because by 1993, cable has now gone from, you know, these operators that are desperate for any type of programming. Now they are no longer desperate. A cable operator perhaps had 30, 40, maybe 50 channels that they could offer, and they wanted programs that were attractive.
Yeah. So what happens to NET?
Just kind of fades away because it does not have the support and, again, the carriage. But the idea still remains, of course.
Yeah. I mean, Weyrich would point to NET as a model for what happened next.
It may be that what we try to do at NET demonstrated that there was a market for right-of-center programming, if you will.
And that brings us to sort of our third prong out of TVN, which is Roger Ailes.
Mm-hmm.
What is he doing in the early 90s as Weyrich is doing NET?
Well, Ailes climbs the ranks in the Republican Party, becomes a really well-known and sought-after media advisor. He's really at the center of Bush's presidential bid in 1988. And then he's trying to figure out his next steps. He wants to get back into the television industry. And he sees cable as a way in. And so he's hired to run CNBC, which is really struggling at the time. But at the same time, NBC is developing plans to launch an all-talk cable channel that would be all talk all day long. And they call it America's Talking. And so he becomes really involved in shaping the direction of America's Talking. And so certainly there were political conversations, but that's not all. They had a variety of other things, you know, an advice show. There's one where people could get tips on therapy. So it's really all over the place in terms of what it does. And again, they tried to keep it more affordable with production. So they encouraged call-in programs, but that meant the shows were not really sophisticated in terms of their production, nor were they very successful.
This is the exact same time that NET is kind of doing the same thing in a different way, and that NET is also feels low production, feels boring, is kind of experimenting with what it is. You've told me at one point their most successful show was a wine tasting show. So even they were moving away from trying to do just purely overtly political content. But America's Talking transforms into another station. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. So it really, so by 1995, it is just it's not doing well. And so NBC is thinking, what are they going to do with this cable channel? And they want to revamp it and relaunch it. And they get into conversations, with Microsoft and say, you know what? We're going to launch a competitor to CNN. And so they launch MSNBC. And when, Bob Wright, the head of NBC, makes this big announcement, notably, Roger Ailes is not there. He is furious, just absolutely furious. And he knows that he is out at NBC and he's trying to figure out what his future is going to be.
Yeah. So America's Talking becomes MSNBC. How do all those experiences we've traced from TVN to CNN to NET, MSNBC, And then finally, what's the piece of the puzzle that, that Ailes figures out?
He figures out that he needs a powerful and deep-pocketed media corporation, and that is Rupert Murdoch and the Fox Corporation. Murdoch had come in the 1980s to establish himself as this independent network outside of the big three, and he had grown his entertainment empire. But he was looking to get involved in the news. He saw the news as a step to having more political power and social prestige. He also sees that this is a successful business strategy because Rush Limbaugh is exploding. And the entire premise of Rush Limbaugh's show hinges on this notion of a liberal media bias that he talks about nonstop. And so there's clearly an audience for this type of programming. It's really the result of four decades of conservative media activists making the consumption of conservative media central to the political identity of conservatives.
I'm kind of obsessed with the question of whether this was sort of the natural evolution or whether the decisions that were made by specific people shaped it in a way that it didn't necessarily need to happen. Do you think that this development that we've kind of charted into today's news ecosystem, and particularly cable news, was inevitable?
No, I don't think it was inevitable. It is one of the things that my research has showed time and time again is that decisions matter. Policy decisions matter. But more significantly, political conversations around how to structure and use media matter. That's why someone like Richard Nixon was so significant to the trajectory of cable television. He saw cable as a part of this war that he's waging against network news and to solve this network news problem, as he terms it. And he very purposely begins to deregulate cable television, which had been very highly regulated in the 1960s. Nixon wanted it to be a competitor. And so he changed the conversation around its possibilities, but also changed the policies. Cable took a very particular path because of political choices and lobbying decisions by the industry and a variety of business incentives.
Katie, your book is about so much more, but how do you reflect on this piece of it? When you look at kind of the development from TVN to Fox News, what stands out to you most?
One of the things I think about a lot is that Fox News and its particular approach, how they thought about the news, it was very much something they wanted to use to gain political power and to make money, not necessarily to inform people. This is really a shift that I trace in the broader book. Cable operators argued that allowing cable to expand, creating diversity on the cable dial, that would serve democracy because it would bring in new voices and elevate the debate. Well, their goal was never about strengthening democracy. It was always about making money. And I think that Fox really embodies that desire for power and for profits that is really at the core of the deregulation of cable. And in the process, you see ideas of the public interest change. And so that's the story of deregulation that is at the heart of the book. It's, you know, people across the political spectrum buy into this idea that the marketplace can deliver for democracy and restructure media institutions around this idea. And that's what we have in our current media and political landscape, something that delivers for the marketplace, but it hasn't always delivered for democracy.
Catherine Kramer Brownell is a professor at Purdue University and author of 24/7 Politics, which charts the rise of cable news. Katie, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me and for the conversation.
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode. If you've enjoyed Landslide and would like another full season, please tell others about the series, rate us, and sign up for our mailing list at nuancetales.com. This bonus episode was produced by me, Ben Bradford, with additional engineering from Matt Bradford. All music is also by Matt Bradford. Landslide is a production of Nuance Tales in partnership with WFAE, distributed by the NPR Network.